Judaism and Judaism, many thanks to Richard Cohen and Norris Edelbaum for hosting the Parliament of Newton, at which the first version of this year was given. So I want to start with a text that I return to very, very frequently. Not because I would agree with it, but because it's really, really challenging. This is the Rambam's Guide to Perplexed, section 1, chapter 2. And I'm going to try to read it now in what I think is the strongest, most challenging way to read it. And we'll find some elements of ways of narrowing it later in this year. But for the purposes of this year, I'm going to leave it really in the way in which I think one would most likely read it if one didn't have any interest in the alternative. And I'll leave it to yourself whether the interest in the alternatives are legitimate and legitimate assumptions that Rama will share them. Because the text says that the intellect enables humanity to distinguish between truth and falsehood, and this was found in Adam perfect and complete. However, the shameful and the appropriate are in the category of the apparent, rather than in the category of the intellectually graspable. One does not subscribe to the spherefulness of the heavens as appropriate, or the flatness of the earth as shameful, but rather as true and false. Okay. Right, so reason, or whatever the capacity of intellect and vision is, able to distinguish in truth and falsehood. And here we go to what is a really astounding exegetical move in omics, tremendously bold move. He says, when Adam rebelled and turned to his imaginative desires and the pleasures of his physical senses, as scripture says that the tree was chose for eating, and that it was desirable to the eyes, Adam was punished by the removal of that intellectual comprehension. So what's startling about the Rambam's interpretation of Chumash here is that he doesn't see the actual eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge as the cause of false humanity from perception. The eating is an almost an incidental side effect of the real thing that just goes wrong. The real thing that goes wrong is that Adam and Chava see that the tree is good for eating and is desirable to the eyes. It seems to me that the easiest way to read that is to say that we have here a distinction between truth and beauty. Truth is what Adam was sentenced to before and after the fall, is when Adam ceases being sensitive exclusively to truth and can be distracted by beauty. And that would seem to put beauty in a fairly negative light from the Jewish perspective. That really we should be the kind of creatures who wouldn't notice if they would notice if a tree was beautiful. I should note that it seems to me that this reading of the Rambam is rooted in a very puzzling mission in Pirkei Avot, which he won't have a chance to do it on his own terms now, where the Mishnah says that somebody who interrupts their living to say how beautiful this tree is, and Ibn Chayyim ben Nafsho deserves, is liable to lose their life. And it seems to me the Rambam read that as a commentary on the first paragraph on the second paragraph of Bereishit. And he just saw, well, you see that beauty, even natural beauty, is only an acceptable distraction from intellectual comprehension. Now, there is a way of reconciling the realm to a certain form of beauty, and that can be found in Keith's name that owes to a Grecian urn, in which the urn says, apparently according to everyone on the internet, channeling Sir Joshua Reynolds, beauty is truth, and truth is beauty. In other words, when the Rambam doesn't have to deny beauty per se, he can acknowledge intellectual beauty, and the beauty of truth, and the truth of beauty, not really meaningful to him, to any beauty which is outside the realm of intellectual truth is irrelevant, and that specifically means to the Rambam excludes beauty
which is based on human experience. And more the specific reference he uses is sense experience, but I think in general, Rama is interested only in beauty that comes from truths that are eternal, as opposed to the truths of experience.
Now, in the contrast to this, I want to take another Gemara,
which I also come back to. Now, I want to say openly that I'm not reading this Gemara in the way that I would if I'm reading this Gemara on its own. In context, there are many, many fascinating things I can say about this Gemara that are important, but I don't think they affect the essential point I want to make tonight in this context. So here's what it says. This is not going to get paid out of an hour. Amar the Yochanan, the Yochanan said, I'm not Ishtari and Shatiri Yishalayim. I am a remnant of the beautiful people of Yishalayim. This is part of the genre on this calendar. Rabbis identifying themselves with particular characteristics, ideal characteristics in the past. But then we have a fascinating parenthetical comment by the end here. Hayman the boy nechfei shufrei Rabbi Yochanan. If one wished to see the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan, naitei kasta de kasta me vesalkei. You should take a silver cup straight from the smithy, the maya partidaya dramana sunka, and fill it with the seeds of a red pomegranate, then have the lake lula the varga sunka from there, and wrap around its rim with red roses. In those days, the shimshar latua, and place it between the sun and the shade, hahud the harura is that radiance. And the ancient shifrid Rabbi Yochanan is a semblance of the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan.
I don't want to use the appreciation of the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan per se as the evidence for the legitimacy, validity, and importance of beauty that comes from human experience in the Talmud. The beauty of Rabbi Yochanan per se here is only a stand-in for the lost beauty of Yerushalayim. And in this sense,
I'm going to open up site. The Gemara on Sukkah, which says that that tells you that the beauty of the Herodian temple was far and away the most beautiful thing and the most beautiful building anyone had ever seen in the world. The beauty of the temple in Bir Rabbi Yochanan has specific religious content. What interests me is the analogy. Okay, here I want to make reference to a beautiful paragraph that Elliot Stern, an SDN alumnus, wrote based on a conversation he had with me some years about Shira Shirin. The point of this paragraph, which is on the search sheet, and I can't do it as well as he did, is that, I'll give you the beginning. If we assume that Shira Shirin is in fact intended to be an allegory, this would mean that the allegorical meaning is the child of the sector. However, to write allegorically means writing with two levels of meaning in mind. The allegory is related by the relationship between literal meaning and the allegorical meaning. Without first understanding the mashal, any interpretation of the mashal is not true to the text. So, what we're saying is that Shir Shirin is supposed to tell us something about an allegory, let's say, of the relationship between Israel and God. It does that by telling us about the relationship between the two lovers in the song. Unless it conveys to us a plausible image of the human relationship, then we can't use the human relationship to understand the divine human relationship, or the Israel-divine relationship. Now, the analogy I want to make here is that in order to convey to us the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan, and thereby to inculcate in us and establish the beauty of Yerushalayim, the author of the Talmud here, first of all, makes an assumption that we will be capable of appreciating the beauty of the analogy that he relates, that we can write. And not only that, but readers have a sufficient capacity to imagine that kind of beauty. Now, let's go through it again. We take a silver cup straight from the smithy, fill it with the seeds of a red pomegranate, surround the rim of red roses, and place it between the sun and the shade. Now, let's suppose I asked you, what's your favorite color? This would be a quite remarkably elaborate answer.
If the kind of energy can only give if you have actually spent a lot of time contemplating beauty and thinking about how can I produce the most beautiful color? How can I produce the most beautiful image in the air? So the author of this text is somebody who has a deep appreciation of and conscious experience of and conscious attempt to experience a beauty, very sensual beauty, beauty that comes from the that comes from sight, and that doesn't talk about it, relate to any to truth in any way. And not only that, the author assumes that the audience has the same kind of experience and appreciation. There's no point in describing a really sophisticated, saying, "Well, that fish is so incredible. Anybody who wants to remember what that dish of food tastes like, they have to do it. Why is it for a whole long recipe to somebody who doesn't know how to cook it and never experienced anything other than, garlic potato chips." So this text seems to me to indicate, and I'm very conscious of reading the Rambam, we've offered a deep validity to beauty that stems from sensual experience, human experience in general. I want to offer a few other texts that have, I think, also the effect of legitimizing the interest in beauty that other than intellectual. The first is a Rashi that really one of my favorite makaras in all of the corpus of the Torah Shabbat test. You know, he gives shir 6 times, which will probably go on for at least a month. The Rashi on Bereshit Aleph Aleph, the phrase Bara Elokim, that is Bara Elokim Velo Amar Bara Hashem. The story of creation is appears in Torah Aleph of Bereshit, and it begins, he uses throughout the name of God Elohim as opposed to the Tetragrammaton. Why? Shabitchila alav machshava levaratil midat hadin, ve'ash ein olam nitayim, ikdim midat harachanim v'shitam midat hadin. And because originally it arose in God's mind, it arose in thought, to create the world with the attribute of justice, midat hadin is the best translation we have right now, not a great translation. Elohim represents this aspect of God's attribute. But God thought the world did not endure, so he placed the attribute of mercy again, midat rachamim, best translation you can give, that she saw midat hadin, and he partnered it with the attribute of justice. And that's why in Parakeh it says, Yom HaTov Hashem Elokim, right, the Shemayim, there you have both things beside. Now, what this Rashi tells us is that the first chapter of Bereshit is not a description of the world that God actually created it. It's a description of the world the way God would have created it had he not seen that such a world could not survive, had he created it with the attribute of justice alone. Now, the logical positivists have a very powerful critique of metaphysics, in which they, among other things, they argued that statements about the characteristics of hypotheticals were meaningless. There's no right or wrong answer to, at least for meaningless from a true false perspective. There's no right or wrong answer to the question of what color is the unicorn, or if you had a brother, would you like potatoes? So now the question of what would the world have been like if God had created it only with the attribute of justice, from the perspective of logical positivism, it seems to me a meaningless question. And yet, according to Rashi, God spends the first chapter of Bereshit answering it. So if that, right, if Parsha of Bereshit is, by that token, meaningless, what the Rambam calls an enough to sheker, a true-false perspective, that must mean that God has an interest in questions other than true-false questions. And since, obviously, Bereshit Perek Aleph is a work of literary art in that sense, it's a spectacularly beautiful piece of writing, that would mean that we have a divine model for the both the interest in non-true-false questions and the production of beauty, which is not in director's talk, the true false question. Another technique goes even further. This may be an overeating. I always admit that I may be overeating this, but I love the overeating. Is Svarna to Breshik Bet, which is building up the Rama. So Svarna identifies the Eitz HaDaat Tovra, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which is what Adam and Chava noticed in the text, sends the Rama's intervention. Seems to be that the important thing is just to eat it, and they acquire the knowledge by eating it as opposed to simply by looking at it. So that tovara, according to Svarna, is lichor ba'arei ha'pupichi yavik, to choose the sweet even though it is it damages. Limosa bilpi arei is to despise and not to be ha'pupichi yavik, even though it is effective. Now, a sort of analogy that what the Rambam doesn't talk about is that the Rambam is that the Nachash claims and the text seems to support God himself seems to support at the end of the story the notion that eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge makes you more like God. And the Rambam in that chapter we read really begins by addressing the question, how could there be knowledge that God does not want us to have? And the answer is that not all forms of knowledge are equal, and some forms of knowledge distract one from other more important forms of knowledge. The question is, does God have that kind of knowledge or not? It sounds like to the Rambam that I think pretty clearly that God does not have or any reason to have the kind of knowledge human beings acquire that way. But Svarna thinks that by eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge, you indeed acquire a form of knowledge which is the kind of knowledge that God has. The capacity to choose the sweet even though it damages, to despise the not sweet even though it's effective. Now, I want to argue that there's a series of midrashim in which God asks the angels whether or not to create humanity, and the angels are always opposed. God, in fact, one version destroys the angels, at least until one group says yes, and then they say yes because they recognize that since God destroyed the previous group who asked the question, so there's no point in opposition, and after the flood, they come back and they say, see, we told you so. Not interested in the initial conversation. The angels tell God not to. Now, why did they tell him not to? It seems to me clear that the angels are telling you that human beings can only damage. The world runs perfectly as it is. It is an absolute reflection of God's will. But what human beings are sweet. Because it's sweet to have the world run because with freedom in accordance, right, and nonetheless in accordance with your own will, as opposed to because it can only run that way mechanically. And that would mean that the creation of human beings by God is the choice of the sweet, even though it is mazik. And there again, that seems to me to offer a warrant for the pursuit of beauty. And particularly, I want to argue that so far we've been talking mostly about the appreciation of beauty. But actually, this is true in terms of the literary production of the gracious fairy elephant, and now I think about the entire creation of human beings. And not only the appreciation of art is an appreciation of something which God values, and the production of beauty is a powerful act in the Tashi Day, because God himself creates beauty, and beauty that is relevant to human, right, relevant to human experience, not the beauty of abstract truth. Okay, now we set up the Gemara of Mitzvah, which explicitly values visual beauty in a very powerful way, and connects that, of course, to a certain kind of erotic beauty. And the Rashi, which values literary creativity, values imagination. And the Svarna, which values the creation of, again, it's a central reference, creation of the sweet even though it damages. We have to talk about what our, that I set up explicitly, I should say, in Parna, in an antinomian context. In Halachic society, it's hard to say, well, the model for what we value is human being's violation of the first mitzvah. We understand perfectly well why that would not work out well in a community which sees itself as bound by mitzvah, as raison d'etre. And I want to hear from them the text of Shem's Olsen. I don't return to it quite as often, which has also been important to me over the years, and I'll talk about what the specific context was where it really became important to me. The Shulchan Aruch Chaim, Shem Zayin, Ted Zayin, 3:7-16, says the following. The figures of speech and the metaphors of non-sacred conversation and words of desire, and Paul's booklet certainly is books that meet that category, surely so stand the Shabbat, which includes the Book of Emmanuel and Books of Words. It's surely so stand the Shabbat, it's forbidden to read in them on Shabbos. And then, it's really interesting language, so far as he doesn't have any other place to put this, it's just a tangent, a long tangent in the middle of the Chod Shabbat. To ask the whole author, right? Forbidden also during the week. Mishum Moshad Leitzim. Now I'm translating Moshad Leitzim as the encampment of those who devalue the valuables and value the valueless. But you should just be aware that culturally this is a really powerful insult to Yeshivas. So Yeshiva Gaiva. Moshad Leitzim is like the ultimate time wasting culture of the not the culture of the total non Yeshiva person. To be accused of being part of the Moshe Leitzim, we have each kind of table in the Torah all in the mission of those. This is deep insult. The Oker Mishum of Kishnil Adonim, and it also violates Chassatus that on its surface means don't turn after false gods. So we're accusing of what is earned, which is also pretty serious, although here specifically the Drasha we're citing as what Kishnil Adonim, don't turn God out of your mind, don't empty your mind of God as opposed to turning towards something else. When we talk about words of desire, it's also the issue of inciting the evil inclination, inciting the libido. So we Amisha Kidram composed the Shulchan Aruch, and so those who compose them, the Amisha Etikan, or who transcribe them, the Insurishal Maramat Kitan, and I mean to say, those who print them, they cause the public to sin. Now, if you think about it, and where I first thought about this was the first year, really the only year I ever had, which I spent in classic Yeshiva model, the only formal study I had was traditional Torah, was how much of what we call valuable in culture, high culture, can be broken down into the Shulchan Aruch category. You know, it turns into Sichat Chulin, right, non-sacred conversation, the different sketches and words of desire, the same different locale, and books of words, history, and books about human relationships. That's pretty much the Shulchan Aruch term for those that seem to be Moshe Leitzim. That's the real challenge. But I want to tell another story which I think illustrates this well. A wonderful Jewish educator who I have tremendous respect for. At one point early in the Adad excitement, there was a conference about Dates of Education, I think. And this educator at this conference on where on earth education should be going spoke with great pride of having removed the catcher in the rye from the curriculum of the school that he had influenced in. Now, I don't like catcher in the rye. One of the kids who really didn't identify with the book, I found its vulgarity meaningless to me. It's just off-putting. Really, really don't like the book. But I was interested in this educator framed the reason that he had the book removed from the curriculum as obviously best for students to read this. So I asked him, have you read the book? And he said, yes. And I said, would you read the book again? And he said, yes. Do you regret having read the book? No. So in what sense did you say the book was out there? And I don't think I got a satisfactory response to that. Now, here's what I want to find out. There are two issues about it. First of all, is that we all, I think, all those of us who live, who see integration as a religious integration as a value, living integrated religious life as a value, and who do appreciate art that isn't explicitly directly aimed at teaching religious truth as having real value, we have to be able to. The two things. A is most of us recognize it. Most of us recognize this, and yet we have to be able to have the language to articulate it. We have to be able to explain why we're not in violation of Shulchan Aruch, which at that point this educator could not. And I didn't really have a good way of answering this for myself either during that year in Israel when all of a sudden it became clear to me that this was possible. Secondly, the story also comes home to me that we have no language for talking about an instinct that matters to us generally, which is how we talk about the different boundaries of experience that ought to be open to teenagers, adults, and things like that. I want to explore things. And so that the educator has no language for talking about why he thought it was utter for high school students, but not at all a bad idea for him to read. And this relates to a much broader question, which now I'm going to try and tie this into a general thesis about modern orthodoxy. The critique I often offer of orthodox education in general is as follows. Rabbi Akiva says, Asher Asherim is Kodesh Kodeshim. Asher Asherim is the Holy of Holies. We run an educational system which basically teaches that the apex of religious experience occurs while you're learning Yeshiva, before you get married. Now, how can the apex of religious experience occur in an environment, in a context, in which we legitimately spend many efforts in making sure that there's no possible way that our students can understand Shereshirim? In which, in essence, we're sort of hoping that Shereshirim will, on some level, not be more meaningful than, as mentioned earlier, the description of the text. The Shereshirim analogizes the religious experience of some aspect of religious experience to human relationships. We're hoping that that's not so much more meaningful than if we took somebody only money and drugs to do a trip and try to teach them religion by reading cookbooks, etc. How can that be? So I think the unifying theme about this, which connects to Shereshirim, which explains the story about Catcher in the Rye, is that we need a halacha which acknowledges the value we see. It acknowledges the value we see in all of human experience. We need a halacha which sees it as valuable to see the beauty in all of human experience. The way I want to frame it grammatically is the halacha that brings all of life to Torah and brings all of Torah to life. Now, that's, you might say, the dream. But I want to point out, here it's been sort of hiding a text from you. So the Ramah, continuation of the same text as previously, comfortably says that maybe these prohibitions only apply to books which are written in foreign languages, Mishnah Dabla Dibara, but in Hebrew, at least you can learn Hebrew from them. There's a word here, says Chulin, because Chulin non-sacred works. This does not include Yosifon, the Sefer Yosef, the Rayam Shor, Yosef Toin, Shemit Yehuda, and doesn't include this whole list of history books. Why? Shemit Hanyim and Dudzik and Mutzer of the year, because from them you can learn words of Mutzer and of religious honest fear. Galkina feels to do the Lakshari. And therefore, even if they're written in foreign languages, they're permitted. Now what that tells you is that none of these are absolute prohibitions. What they are instead is statements that it does not make sense to study these things if you see them as bringing you no value. To do things that contain elements of being the Gari Torah, the recitation of all those, right, for most of least seem why. But if you see them as having value, then there's no formal prohibition, because those are the kind of, I understand that all positive religious experiences carry with them risk. So there's nothing about the halakha as such that prevents us from that is antagonistic to this monarchist ideal of faith force of the Torah that has all of life brought to it. But we need the language to express that. We need people who understand how Lacan can frame that. We need to be willing to submit, right, to our experiences to the critique of halakha, which is of course the ways in which sometimes experiences are subject to critique, how one chooses one experiences, all those sorts of issues. But if we're going to have a non-Orthodox community that lives fully a thorough life the way we wish it ought, and develops the Torah that it is its responsibility to, then we need to produce a Torah leadership that shares our interest in valuing those experiences. So in the same way as education, where we now talk about educating the whole child, this is part of NXT, the development of children's artistic capacities as an essential element of, or an important element of developing the talent of a student within them. So the halakha that shares that sees the value in the development of artistic capacity and the production of giving in those sorts of ways. In order to put myself on the line, and I guess to some degree explain why this matters to me, because I've also, at the end of the Mikroshi, I'm not going to go through them with you now, I have given you a citation from the Rav, which is important to me also. I didn't want to build a share on it because the Rav and even more so Cook now have hit the point where you can mine their words to the paragraph that agrees with you as well. But I think that the Rav, the paragraph split here, which has always been important to me at least, about the significance, the religious, almost paradigm religious significance of creativity is relevant here. And then again, put myself on the line, I put two poems of my own at the end. Both these poems are exactly on theme. And on one hand, they're pure Torah to me. They're written as midrashim designed to solve exegetical problems. To solve the way I understand midrash, to solve exegetical problems in the text through really rigorous close reading. And it happens that they solve these problems in a manner which gives tremendous significance to human experience. So I encourage you to read them on your own, and I hope that we're having any further conversations about this in the future. This is a preliminary attempt, which I hope will, I plan and expect that the Summer Baby Drash of 2012, I guess, a year from this summer, we'll take up the topic of the halakha and art. And so I hope that I'll have conversations with many of you before then, and that you will be interested in helping the Center Fund for Leadership grow to what it ought to be, in helping build a community that brings all of life to Torah, all of Torah to life. Thanks very much.